and then get started. Again, glad to have everybody here on a beautiful, beautiful and wonderful Sunday morning. Genesis chapter 25. And we'll read just verse 1 and then we'll have a prayer. Genesis 25:1 says, "Then again, Abraham took a wife and her name was Keturah." Let's say a word of prayer. Father, again, thank you for the chance to gather together this morning. We ask, Father, you bless each and every heart and soul here this morning and bless those that can't be here for whatever reason. Father, those that may be sick, those that may be in the hospital, Father, we ask to reach out and bless and touch them. And Father, we ask now as we open your word to teach, Father, you give me the words I need to say, and Father, help us to say the words that need to be said. Thankful the chance to gather together. Bless the service to come. Bless our speaker this morning and this evening. Father, give him the words that we need to hear. Bless us now, we ask in Jesus' name. Amen. So what we started last week, before that magic bell went off and interrupted me, I got to find that bell and take it away. You know, the one that says Sunday school's over, I got to hide that bell. I want to keep going. Was that Abraham has decided to remarry. Now, he's 140 years old. His wife has been gone now for some time, 3 years. And it was a tradition in those days that your wife helped run the household, of course. There was a lot of servants. And Abraham was very rich and very, very successful, a herdsman. And it was just very difficult to run a household without a wife. And he was lonely. And, of course, he had to fulfill the divine mandate to multiply. The Lord said, you will multiply and populate. And so he got remarried, had 6 sons with his next wife, which is fulfilling that mandate. And so this we see why he got remarried. And then we see that also, that despite the sons that they had with the remarriage, he made sure that Isaac had the covenant, that it was clear to Isaac that he had the covenant. And so read in verses 5 and 6, 25:5, "And Abraham gave all that he had unto Isaac." So he made it clear Isaac was to have the inheritance. He was to have the covenant that God had promised him. And verse 6, "But he took care of his other sons as well. But unto the sons of the concubines which Abraham had, Abraham gave gifts and sent them away from Isaac his son while he yet lived eastward unto the east country." So he gave them gifts, he made sure they were taken care of, and they made sure they were separate. So there's no arguments, no contentions between the sons that he had with the concubines and with Isaac. He was establishing Isaac as a clear inheritance owner. And so this gave Isaac unchallenged precedence as Abraham's heir. What's just what he needed? And so as we move forward, we see that some 38 years after Sarah's death, 35 years after Abraham remarries, and with Isaac now 75 years old, Abraham passes away, dies at the age of 175 years old. Verse 7, "And these are the days of the years of Abraham's life, which he lived, and 115 years. Then Abraham gave up the ghost and died in a good old age, an old man and full of years, and was gathered to his people." A wonderful testimony to the life of Abraham. And so it does make me wonder, because I'm an old man, how many more years I got left, but that's in God's hands, right, John? All right, John. He says, I'm not that old, but I'm not 140, but some days I feel like it, 175. But so he was had a good old age, an old man full of years, and was gathered unto his people. And we see here that Ishmael and Isaac, which had contention in the past, they reunite to bury their father. He was buried in the same cave he purchased for Sarah in Genesis chapter 23. Verse 9 says, "And his sons Isaac and Ishmael buried him in the cave of Malpekah in the field of Ephron, the son of Zotar the Hittite, which is before Mamre. The field which Abraham purchased of the sons of Heth, there was Abraham buried in Sarah his wife." So they were buried together in the same spot, and a wonderful end to the life of Abraham. Now God blesses Isaac, and he chooses to live in a very special place that we heard about in the previous story in verse 11. "And it came to pass after the death of Abraham that God blessed his son Isaac, and Isaac dwelt by the well of Lahoria." Now, what is the well of Lahoria? You remember the well? This was the same place where Hagar was met by the angel when she was cast out, and the angel came and provided for her and her son, Ishmael. So the wonderful symmetry here is terrific. And so this is where Isaac had decided to go to and live in. And the well, the meaning of the well of the name is well of the living one who sees me, which is what Hagar said when the angel visited her and met her needs after she'd been cast out. And so progressing rapidly to where we were last week, verses 12 through 15 gives us the descendants of Ishmael. And in verse 16, we see the promise of God fulfilled in the life of Ishmael. Remember, Ishmael had been told he would have 12 princes. His sons would be, he would be the father of 12 princes. And so he said in verses 16 and 17, "These are the sons of Ishmael, which and these are their names by their towns and by their castles, 12 princes according to their nations. And so that promise and that covenant was fulfilled by God. Now Ishmael dies at 137 years old. And again, lifespans are expanded here. They're not what they were in the old times with the patriarchs. They lived 900 years, but they're still expanded. 137 years is not that unusual. Verse 17, and these are the years of the life of Ishmael, 137 years, he gave up the ghost and died and was gathered unto his people. And they dwelt from Havilah unto Shur, that is before Egypt, and as thou goest toward Assyria, and he died in the presence of all his brethren. Again, another great summary to a life of Ishmael. Despite the contention, despite the problems they had, he died in the presence of all his brethren. Now we get to where we were last week in verses 21 through 27, where it's described the birth of Isaac and Rebekah's twin sons, Esau and Jacob. And we look down at verse 21. Rebekah is having some issues here with. Now, again, I said last week, I never had babies. If men had to have babies, our generation would last. Well, it wouldn't last. We wouldn't have any babies. This would be the last generation. Men, I mean, I don't know how women do it. And so both of our babies were born. I was sitting there going, go, baby, go, sweetheart. Yay, go. And she looked at me like, get out of here. The first one was born in the Philippines. And as I said last week, they had a wonderful hospital at Clark Air Base in the Philippines because there were so many kids born, they were very good at it. But when Stephanie was born, she was born in the evening time. And so the rule was if you're born after 6 p.m., they spend their first night in the nursery so mom can get some sleep. And so the next morning I come in with my flowers, my candy, want to see my daughter, my wife. I come in and my wife says, sit down. Where's Stephanie? Sit down. What's up? She's in the ICU. Excuse me? Yeah. She'd ingested amniotic fluid during the birth, and when the nurse went to go feed her at 2 a.m., she was blue from lack of oxygen. So immediately took her to the ICU, put her in an oxygen tent, gave her a big IV needle, and she was fine. She was 8 pounds and 9 ounces, something like that. So that's why I referred to her last week as a cow. My wife has promised to call her and tell her I said that. Another trip to my Amazon website. I can see that one coming. But she was very healthy other than that issue. And they put her in the very back of the ICU. So when other parents came in to see their poor, very, very premature little things, they didn't want to see this 8-pound, 5-ounce cow walking to see their poor little. So they put her all the way in the back. And so she was there for 8 days. So the giving birth is so difficult anyway. And when that happens, it makes things even more. Our second child was born in California, and she came out blue because the cord had been wrapped around her neck. And then the nurse took her and did the oxygen, and she was fine. I still said last week, I still accuse them both of having brain damage from those events when they say something I don't agree with. And so, but they're both fine. But, I mean, no more children because we don't want any more Smurfs. We've had 2 blue babies. We don't want any more Smurfs. But just the idea of giving birth is so difficult. But here she's pregnant with twins. One's bad enough, but twins. And she's having a difficult time. And we see that in verse 21 where Isaac entreated the Lord for his wife because she was barren, and the Lord was entreated of him, and Rebekah, his wife, conceived. Now, again, this is Isaac is 60. At this point, he entreats the Lord for Rebekah after 20 years of marriage, which because she's barren. Maybe he entreated too much because now she's pregnant with twins. The Lord blessed her twice for the request. In verse 22, and the children struggled together within her, and she said, if it be so, why am I thus? And she went to inquire of the Lord. Now, is it wrong to ask the Lord why? No, it's not. Of course not. We can always ask the Lord, why is this happening and why is that happening, as long as we don't take it for granted that it's God's will for our life. And this was God's will for her life. But she wanted to say, why am I going through this? Can you help me? She inquired of him, can you help me? And then God reveals in verse 23 that there are two nations in her womb, two peoples that will be divided, and the elder shall serve the younger. That's very important because we'll see that later. Now, again, she wasn't complaining. She was simply asking the Lord, what's happening here? And we see in verse 23, and the Lord said unto her, two nations are in thy womb, and two manner of people shall be separated from thy bowels. And the one people shall be stronger than the other people. And in key verse here, and the elder shall serve the younger. Traditionally, that's not the way it was. The firstborn always had the inheritance. The firstborn was always the leading child in the family. And the Lord says here very clearly to Rebekah, the elder shall serve the younger. And that's key as we move forward. So now the twin sons are born. Now, as we talked about before, the normal traditional rules are reversed. The elder shall serve the younger. This was God's divine choice, contrary to tradition. But this was God's choice. Rebekah knew that. God had told her this. And so if his choice had been honored with honor, the outcome would have been much better for everybody concerned. Because as we see going forward, there's conflict in this regard. Verse 24, and when her days to be delivered were fulfilled, behold, there were twins in her womb. And the first came out red, all over like a hairy garment, and they called his name Esau. And after that came his brother out, and his hand took hold of Esau's heel, and his name was called Jacob. And Isaac was 80 years old when she bare them. Now Esau, firstborn, he came out red and hairy. Okay, Esau means red. And so, and Jacob came out grabbing onto his brother's heel, earning the name Jacob, which means supplanter or takes by the heel. Interesting name. And so, why was Jacob holding on to Esau's heel? What does that signify? It symbolizes their lifelong rivalry, which they will have, and a sign for the desire of the birthright. Jacob desired the birthright, so he's hanging on to his brother's heel. It was also a sign of God's choice that the younger brother would have the traditional inheritance over the older brother. So the tradition would be flipped upside down. And that Esau and Jacob represents two different peoples and two different nations, the Edomites and the Israelis. And so this was God's plan, but it created conflict in the family. And we'll see in verse 27 that the two boys have very different and contrasting personalities. Verse 27 says, and the boys grew, and Esau was a cunning hunter, a man of the field, and Jacob was a plain man dwelling in tents. This causes a conflict. This causes a problem inside the family. And we'll see that in verse 28. And Isaac loved Esau because he did eat of his venison. And Rebekah loved Jacob. Now, I love a steak. I'm sorry. I like my steaks. Well done. If it's got any blood in it, send it back. And Jackie's is burn it. Because she's the same way. So obviously Isaac loved his T-bone steaks. And Paul said, if you have a T-bone steak, you have to have a baked potato. It's the law. And so he loved the venison. And so he loved Esau, his firstborn son, because he was a hunter. He was an outdoorsman. And he loved to eat of the venison. But Rebekah loved Jacob because, again, she knew that Jacob would be the inherited son. He would be the leader. And, of course, she also loved the fact, as it said, he's a plain man dwelling in tents. And so the parents preferred each other's son, and that's going to cause, again, more conflict. It was an open display of favoritism, which established a dysfunctional family environment. Anybody ever had a dysfunctional family environment? All right, it's not the greatest thing to grow up in. And so that dysfunction will continue and will contribute to the deceit that we'll see and the conflict we'll see moving forward. So in verse 29, we see that Jacob is cooking food. And this is a historic and a very famous incident. Jacob is cooking food, and his brother comes in from the field while hunting. And he didn't find any game. He didn't manage to get anything. And boy, is he hungry. And we'll see here in verse 29, and Jacob sawed pottage. And Esau came from the field, and he was faint. Now again, the sod means to boil or to cook, and pottage is a red lentil soup or a thick stew. So that's what that means. And so verse 30, and Esau said to Jacob, feed me, I pray thee, with that same red pottage, for I am faint. Therefore was his name called Edom. Now, because of his desperate request for food and the reddish color of the stew, Esau received the nickname Edom, which means red. So even back in those days, they gave him nicknames. So at this point, Jacob makes a very highly unusual and even a dishonorable request. He says in verse 31, and Jacob said, sell me this day thy birthright. Now, why would he say that? That's a strange thing to say. Esau clearly knew that he shouldn't be doing this. He shouldn't sell his birthright. Jacob clearly knew from his mother that he was going to be the leader, that God had promised her that he would be leading even though he was the younger son. So here, Jacob's trying to get ahead of God's plan. God already told him he's going to be the leading son. But he wants to get ahead of things. He wants to take it in his own hands and do it himself by having his brother sell him his birthright for food, Was that a great move? No, it really was kind of not a great move on his part. But he took advantage of the situation. Now, this birthright gave the son precedence over his brother and entitled him to a double share of his father's inheritance. So economically was a big thing, but also just family tradition made a very large thing to have. And so Esau's presented with this conundrum. He's hungry. He's really, really hungry. And all he has to give up is his birthright. And so we see what he does in verse 32. And Esau said, "Behold, I am at the point to die. And what profit shall this birthright do to me?" Now, was Esau really going to die from lack of food? Probably not. But he was hungry. You ever been really, really hungry? I mean, you feel like, you know, you're about to pass out. You're really, really hungry. Am I making you hungry even talking about it? So, well, I'll stop. But Esau was convinced he just was about to die. And this also showed he didn't really honor the birthright that much. If you're willing to give it up, then how much is it worth to you for a cup of soup? And so even he is not doing what he should be doing here. And he said in verse 33, "And Jacob said, 'Swear to me this day.' And he swore unto him, and he sold his birthright unto Jacob. Then Jacob gave Esau bread and pottage of lentils, and he did eat and drink and rose up and went his way. Thus Esau despised his birthright for a cup of lentil soup." And so again, this was not the best way to handle a situation on Jacob's part or Esau's part. Now, was Jacob wrong in asking for his brother's birthright in exchange for food? Yes, it was. It wasn't an honest thing to do. He was taking advantage of a situation. And remember, when Rebecca asked God for help during her pregnancy, God told her in verse 23, "And the elder shall serve the younger." She had doubtless told this to her sons, or at least to Jacob. He knew that God had promised that he would be the leading son. And yet he took advantage of a situation to get the birthright through some conniving means. And so it's never right to do something right the wrong way. It's never right. I mean, even when we go out, like we're doing door hangers this week, and it's our hard and fast rule. We walk up to a house and it says, no solicitation. We don't put a door hanger on their door. We're going to honor that sign. Now, we could say, well, I'm serving God, and I'll do it. And I go put one on the door hangers anyway. Is that right thing to do? No, even though it's the right thing to get God's word out. But what is it doing to our testimony if we're seen violating those kinds of small things? The church, somebody opens it, they see it, they go, I thought I had no soliciting sign. These people are, I'm never going to go to the church again because they didn't obey my sign. I mean, it doesn't lead for good testimony. The same thing about if you have an argument with somebody. And we'll see that later on in the study today. Is it right to argue with somebody? Not if at all possible. I mean, remember the protesters out there yesterday near our house? They had all the No Kings protesters. And they got these really, really mean, ugly signs. And and you want to roll the window down and say, get a job. Or, I mean, just something. But there's no way to win that. And there's no reason to argue with them. They have the First Amendment right to do that. They're within their rights. They're not really harming anything. And even though I don't agree with their signs, if I went out there and start arguing with them, what am I going to win? Am I going to win the argument? Probably not. But I'm certainly not going to do my testimony any good if I'm seen out there arguing with somebody. Even if I'm arguing about the Bible. Should we argue about the Bible? No. I mean, we'll see that later on as well. I think the KJV is wrong. Somebody will say, well, you're entitled to your opinion. But if I argue with you about it, then I stand a chance of losing my testimony and arguing for that. I'm going to stand my case. I'm going to make my case. But we try to avoid those kinds of entanglements because it harms our testimony. I don't mean to be a turtle and bring in your shell every time somebody looks at you crossways. But we have to maintain our testimony. And here Jacob lost his testimony. He did the wrong thing, even though he thought it was for the right reason. God had promised him the birthright. And yet he still connived and tricked his own brother and is selling him his birthright for a cup of lentil soup. And so a wrong method to a right goal is how folks have described this. They've also called him the righteous deceiver, which is not a good title to have, a conniving trickster. And so we'll see more in chapter 27 how this bears out. But Esau, for his part, was wrong in giving up his birthright so easily. And so both are wrong here. And so and we'll see that Jacob pays for this the rest of his life. And so it is a deception that is staggering, and we'll see more later. But it's just never right to do a wrong thing, even for good reasons. We see this even in churches, where churches will offer all kinds of incentives to come to church other than hearing God's word. I mean, there's been classic examples of churches going out on bus rides and giving kids candy and all kinds of, well, that's okay, but is it the right thing to do to have them come to church and they go, well, it's not what I thought was told it was going to be, just to get them in the door, just to get numbers up. And so we have to make sure that our testimony is clean when we deal with people this way, so then we can look back and say, you connived me, you tricked me. You shouldn't have done that. And so we see that here with Jacob. And so that's the end of chapter 25. And it's a disturbing trend that we see in Jacob that we'll see more in chapter 26. Now, chapter 26, the covenant is affirmed. We see family deception and we see family dissension. And so in this chapter deals solely with Isaac and Rebekah. We'll hear more about Joseph later. A new famine is struck in the land of Canaan. And this is distinct from the one that occurred during Abraham's lifetime. And we'll see that in verse 1 of chapter 26. And there was a famine in the land beside the first famine that was in the days of Abraham. And Isaac went into Abimelech, king of the Philistines, into Gerar. Now again, this Abimelech is not the same Abimelech as the other Abimelech. Did I say that right? Is that right? Okay. This is almost like a title, almost like Pharaoh or king. This isn't his name. So this is a different man than we saw in Pharaoh's time, because obviously this was many years before. And so we see that this crisis forces Isaac to leave his home, move to Gerar in the territory of Abimelech, king of the Philistines. While technically occupied by the Philistines, Gerar was still part of the land that God had promised Isaac. They would give him and to his offspring. So it's still a promised land, even though the Philistines inhabit the land. Now God gives Isaac specific instructions as to what to do during the famine in verse 2. And the Lord appeared unto him and said, go not down into Egypt. Dwell in the land which I shall tell thee of. Sojourn in this land, and I will be with thee, and will bless thee. For unto thee and unto thy seed I will give all these countries, and I will perform the oath which I swear unto Abraham thy father. And then verse 4, and I will make thy seed to multiply as the stars of heaven, and will give unto thee, unto thy seed, all these countries. And in thy seed shall all the nations of the earth be blessed. A wonderful covenant that God had reaffirmed to Isaac at this time. And so they move, they go down to Gerar, and they take up residence there. And verse 5, because that Abraham obeyed my voice and kept my charge, my commandments, my statute, and my law. So God is acknowledging Abraham's faithfulness and rewards him and passes on to Isaac the promise of the covenant. Now, Isaac obeys the Lord. He stays in Gerar and is about to repeat an old family tradition, which is not a good one, but he's about to repeat a family tradition. Verse 6, and Isaac dwelt in Gerar. Verse 7, and the men of the place asked him of his wife. And he said, she's my sister. For he feared to say, she is my wife, lest, said he, the men of the place should kill me for Rebekah, because she was fair to look upon. Sound familiar? It happened before. And so they're repeating a bad family tradition. Now, this is not the same leader, it wasn't the leader who said this in the previous time. This was the men of the area. And again, the tradition was if they saw a woman they wanted, if she was not married, they would take her. If she was married, they'd kill the husband and take her anyway. This is the way the Philistines moved. And so he said, I'm my sister. So he was fearful of being killed for his wife. And same thing, the same lack of faith his father displayed. And again, it was a common occurrence for this to happen. So he's protecting himself, trying to protect himself at least. Now in verse 8, Abimelech sees the deception. Verse 8, and it came to pass, when he had been there a long time, that Abimelech, king of the Philistines, looked out a window and saw, and behold, Isaac was sporting with Rebekah, his wife. Now sporting means intimate behavior, hugging, kissing, whatever, times things you only do with your wife in public. And so he looks out the window and sees this going on, immediately knows this is indeed his wife. And so he takes steps immediately to clear up the situation because he doesn't want to make sure that nothing bad happens to him or his people. He also makes sure nothing bad happens to Rebekah because that would be terrible. Verse 9, and Abimelech called Isaac and said, behold, of a surety, she is thy wife. And how sayest thou, she is my sister? And Isaac said to him, because I said, lest I die for her. Now, the king is appalled at this revelation. Now, had he heard stories about Abraham in the past doing the same thing? Possibly. Perhaps he was seeing history repeat itself. But he took immediate steps to stop the situation in verse 10. And Abimelech said, why is this thou hast done unto us? One of the people might lightly have lain with thy wife, and thou shouldest have brought guiltiness upon us. Now, in response to this news, the king makes an immediate decree, verse 11. And Abimelech charged all his people, saying, he that toucheth this man or his wife shall surely be put to death. So Abimelech acts with honor and integrity here in protecting both Isaac and Rebekah, despite the deception he had used to him before. And in verse 12, then Isaac sowed in the land and received in the same year 100-fold, and the Lord blessed him. So despite his failure, despite his lack of faith, God said, promised to bless him. Do you see what we do? Are we always faithful that we should be? No, and yet God still blesses us. I mean, I can recount all kinds of times that God has blessed me beyond my means. But I look back on my life going, hey, Dave, you didn't do so hot. But God says, well, I'm going to bless you anyway because you're one of my children. And God does that to us all the time. If we really got blessed according to our means, that would be a difficult situation for many of us, including myself. So God blesses us despite sometimes our failures, because we are human and God understands that. And here, he's human and he failed and God still blessed him. And so verse 13, and the man waxed great and went forward and grew until he became very great. Talking about Isaac here. 14, for he had possessions of flocks and possessions of herds and great stores of servants, and the Philistines envied him. So another conflict is about to arise. Now he's living in amongst the Philistines. Even though this is promised land, God's land, the Philistines are living there. And he moves in, and just like his father, he can't help but be successful. God's blessing him. He's got great, huge herds. He's got lots of servants. He's a very famous for his herds, but he's a very rich guy. And the Philistines are going, look at this guy in our land making all this money. And they envied him. And so troubles begin to brew. They didn't like his success because of God's blessing. They didn't like the fact he was living among them with his success. And they're very jealous of what he was doing. And they said in verse 15, for all the wells which his father's servants had digged in the days of Abraham, his father, the Philistines had stopped them and filled them with earth. So in their jealous rage, they decided to get even in a petty way of filling in the wells that Abraham had dug years before. Now, why are wells important? Because water is very important in this part of the earth at this time. I mean, they're in the basically in the desert. Water was obviously extremely important. So if you had a well that was providing water, it was extremely valuable. And also was a sign of, you know, wealth of yourself, but also a sign of intelligence that you found and able to dig a well that provided water. So it was a great sign of success. And the Philistines said, I know what I'll do. I'll fill that one in with dirt. I'll show them what's what. And so they did. It was a demonstration both of displeasure with Isaac, and to harm him, given the fact that water was so important in this region. So the king finally steps in to protect the feelings of his own people and asks Isaac to leave the city in verse 16. And Abimelech said unto Isaac, go from us, for thou art much mightier than we. So the king is saying, my people are upset that you're the Elon Musk of the area. Okay, you're doing way too well for us. So please move out so my people won't be upset. You know, it might be protective for you as well to get away from them. And so he asked him to leave. Now, Abimelech doesn't argue. Isaac doesn't argue. He doesn't complain. He didn't complain about the walls being sabotaged. He didn't complain about being asked to leave. He just trusted, his trust in God is complete. This is my point earlier, is that when things happen, we should trust in God and don't try to pick a fight. Even though, you know, part of me likes to pick fights and I have to rebel against that. I have a little person inside of me called Evil Dave. And Evil Dave likes to do bad things and I have to beat him up all the time. And so it's that my nature. And so driving around yesterday, I wanted to roll the window down and yell, get a job! But I didn't. I just Evil Dave has to be kept inside his little fence. And so here, Isaac doesn't argue. He just complies. Verse 17. And Isaac departed thence and pitched his tent in the valley of Gerar and dwelt there. Now he lived in the city area, and now he's moving out into the valley. Still the same area, same city, but in the valley area. He's getting outside the city and living in the valley area. But it's the same general area. So despite being forced to move, the act shows that Isaac's faith in God is complete and will work everywhere he goes. So Isaac and his servants are now living in the valley. They decide to redig the wells Abraham had initially dug and that the Philistines had filled in. Verse 18. And Isaac digged again the wells of water, which he had digged in the days of Abraham his father, for the Philistines had stopped them after the death of Abraham, and he called their names by the names by which his father had called them. So these wells haven't been filled in by the Philistines. He's now redigging them. He knows there's water there. Man, they need water. He's living in the valley now. He needs water. And they redig them, and they get water again. But the locals aren't happy with it. Verse 19. And Isaac's servants digged in the valley, and they found there a well of springing water. And the herdmen of Gerar did strive with Isaac's herdmen, saying, "The water is ours." And they called the name of the well Esek, which they strove with him. Strove means to argue or contest. And Esek means, is defined as the word contention. And so they undig the well, dug the wells, got water again. The local herdsman said, "But that's ours. Leave it alone, it's mine." And so this contention is ongoing. And now, had the herdsman heard of Isaac and his prosperity in the city before he moved out into the valley? Probably. They probably knew about him. And so once they waited for him to get the well dug, and once the water came up, that's mine. And so the contention exists. And so the digging of the wells and the contention continues in the next verse, as long as I can get there. Verse 21, and they digged another well, and strove for that or argued about that also, and he called the name of it Sinnah. And the herdsmen continued their petty behavior and arguing that every well they redug and found water in was theirs. And it's just petty on them to do this. But undeterred and unwilling to argue or confront this unfriendly and inhospitable act, Isaac and his servants dug yet another well. The patience is wonderful here. I mean, he has every right to contest this, but he doesn't because he knows he's living amongst them. He might win the argument, but he's going to lose the war. And so he decides to dig another well. Verse 22. And he removed from thence and digged another well, and for that they strove not. And he called the name Reboeth, for he said, "For now the Lord hath made room for us, and we shall be fruitful in the land." So Reboeth means room or spaciousness. So he finally finds an area where he dug a well, and they were not going to argue about it. He had avoided conflict the previous times, and God had rewarded him with yet another well that provided water. This was not one that had already been previously dug, and so when you dig a well from scratch, you're taking a chance you're not going to find any water. But God provided, they found water, and that's what they needed to survive. Now, again, could Isaac have fought back? Legally, probably yes, but what would have achieved? He's living amongst them. We live amongst the world. Are we going to win every argument? No. Should we argue? Probably not. We shouldn't seek confrontation. We should try to avoid it. And certainly there are times to stand up and go, you know, beyond here and no further, especially when it comes to affecting church and our religion and our ability to gather together and serve and serve God and meet in a religious environment. There are certainly people who love to stop that, and we have to fight those kinds of activities. But in this case, this was not worth it for Isaac to fight them because he knew that God would provide, and so he did. It also caused lasting disruption with the inhabitants of the area. He wanted to live there. And if he fought with them and contended with them, there would always be this issue with these locals. And so he didn't want to do that. So the lesson is to avoid fighting a battle if it obstructs or prevents from winning the war. And so every day we fight these little battles. When we first came to the church, I know that wherever we were going to sit was probably going to be somebody else's seat. And we didn't want to sit in somebody else's seat. So we looked around and found somebody could have said, "That's my seat." Nobody said that. I don't know if we were in somebody's seat or not, but I mean, no one came to me and said, "That's my seat, move." So you may have won the battle by making us move, but you're going to lose the war because we might have come back. And so we must make sure we don't do that when people come visit us. That's not your seat. It's the church's seat. Welcome them in and find someplace else to sit. And the other one, "You're in my parking place." You're in my parking place. It's not really your parking place. But again, you may ask somebody to move, and you may win that battle, and they may never come back again because you display this combative behavior. I saw a video last night of a lady who, this guy parked his motorcycle in a parking place. It was a rather large motorcycle, and it's perfectly legal to do that. She wanted the parking place for herself. Apparently, it was a crowded area. So she decided to pick the motorcycle up and was going to move it. Now, anybody who knows the name of motorcycles knows that's not a smart thing to do because motorcycles don't just move like that. So she picked the motorcycle up, and then it collapsed and it fell and broke the motorcycle. And then the man who owned the motorcycle sued her, and she said, "Well, he should have been parked there. Should have been there. Legal parking place." So she had to pay $30,000 to have the motorcycle fixed. So she didn't even win the battle, much less the war. But there are times when we should see these kind of things and just walk away because the contention is not worth it. And Isaac was rewarded for his patience with a new well, and God has reaffirmed his covenant. So we need to find ways to resolve conflicts, not engage in them. And boy, I wish we could find ways politically to disagree agreeably and not argue like we are doing these days. So we get to pray for that. And this Isaac is a perfect example of this. So Isaac now moves to Beersheba to find peace and divine reassurance following this intense dispute he's had with the Philistines over the water rights. God appears to him, reaffirms the covenant promised to his father Abraham, and promises to bless him in verse 23. And he went up thence. He went up from thence to Beersheba. And the Lord appeared unto him the same night and said, I am the God of Abraham, thy father. Fear not, for I am with thee and will bless thee and multiply thy seed for my servant Abraham's sake. And he built an altar there and called upon the name of the Lord and pitched his tent there. And there Isaac's servants digged a well, yet another well. And so they separate themselves even a little further out to Beersheba to get away from all this contention as time has passed. And yet, here comes Abimelech. Here comes the king. He asked Isaac to leave the city. He had first asked Isaac to leave the city to go out into the valley because his people were jealous of what he was doing. Now, was he aware of the grief that the locals were causing him in the valley? Probably, because he was the king. And was he aware that the strides that Isaac had taken to avoid the conflict with the locals over this well? Maybe, maybe not. But in any regard, he comes back to Isaac in verse 26. Then Abimelech went to him from Gerar, and Ahaziah, one of his friends, and Phicol, the chief captain of his army. And Isaac said unto them, wherefore come ye to me, seeing ye hate me, and have sent me away from you? So clearly, Isaac wasn't excited to see him. I mean, they had sent him away, and they had problems with the people, and here comes the king again. And so Isaac is a little, what are you doing here? And so, but Isaac's testimony and how he behaved during the situation spoke volumes to the king. In verse 28, and they said, we saw certainly that the Lord was with thee. And we said, let there be now an oath betwixt us, even betwixt us and thee, and let us make a covenant with thee. So clearly Isaac behaved in a way that appealed to the king, and he wanted to make an oath to him. He wanted to make peace with him because he thought he was a good person to have around. And so there that testimony pays dividends. If you've got a good testimony, it pays really good dividends. And we see examples in history where people with good testimonies are rewarded for having that testimony regardless of the surroundings they're in. And it's another example here in God's Word. So can people see God's love in you when they see you and the way you act, the way you respond to them? Again, handing out the door hangers, this was Thursday. And it was cold and it was windy and it was about to rain on us. And we were out there and one of the last houses I got to, this lady was sitting in her car. Didn't have a no soliciting sign, so I walked up, and I handed it to her. And she started telling me her history of her medical problems. And I said, well, bless your heart. She had this done, that done, everything. I said, well, bless your heart. You need to come to church. We'll pray for you. If you come to church, we'll be happy to pray for you. Now, what if I got up and said, I don't care. I got to move on. I don't hear your problems. That would have been a great testimony, would it? Would she probably come to church? No. And so engaging with her in a brief conversation and offering to pray for her, I'm setting seeds, trying to set seeds, maybe will result in fruit later on. So that testimony, even if she never comes to church, at least she can't say anything bad about her church the way we behaved with her. And so that's why the testimony is very important. And so, now, in verse 29, we'll see what the king says. This is the oath he wants to make. That thou wilt do us no hurt, and we have not touched thee, and as we have done unto thee nothing but good, quotation marks there, and have sent thee away in peace, quotation marks there too. Thou art now the blessed of the Lord. Now they sealed a treaty with a feast because they're Baptists. They had to eat. And so they had a feast and then they left in peace. Verse 30. And he had made them a feast and they did eat and drink. And they rose up bedtimes in the morning and swore one another. And Isaac sent them away and they departed from him in peace. So the treaty was made. Isaac's men had dug another well and found water. Verse 32. And it came to pass the same day that Isaac's servants came and told him concerning the well which they had digged, and said unto him, we have found water. And he called it Sheba, therefore the name of the city Beersheba unto this day. Now, Sheba means oath or seven, and clearly the meaning here is oath. And you say, how can one word mean two things? Well, we have lots of words that mean two things. Block. What is a block? I can solid material I build houses with, or I hit you in the football field. That's a block. Bowl means food, thing full of liquid, or a bowling ball going down the alley. So we have words that have double meanings as well. In this case, the word oath is what's effective here. And so now, the chapter ends with very sad news because of Jacob's deception and taking Esau's birthright, Esau takes a step which is displeasing to his entire family. Verse 34. And Esau was 40 years old when he took to wife Judith, the daughter of Bera, and Hittite, the Hittite, and Bathshemoth, the daughter of Elon, the Hittite, which was a grief of mind unto Isaac and to Rebekah. This, he's married outside the family. He's gone outside of his own family to marry, which is something that you're not supposed to do. He did this in part because of the way he'd been treated, the deception he'd been subjected to. And this caused a deep rift between the brothers themselves, as well as between Esau and his parents. We'll see later that his father still loved Esau greatly. But this was just, was this done out of spite, possibly, because he'd been done so badly? Either way, he marries outside the family, which causes him grief at the end of chapter 26. We'll start chapter 27, get as far as we can in the next few minutes. We'll see in chapter 27, we see a sad and disturbing deception of an aging Isaac by his wife and his son. It's very disturbing to read this because, again, the deception continues, and it's even worse this time. And we hear of Christians sometimes participating in deception to build up numbers in a church or to try to get whatever recognition. You think of the televangelists back in the 80s and 90s that were on TV and they were selling everything in the world and not doubt their Christianity, but their the way they went about it was just not great. And so we must try to avoid these traps and avoid employing these kind of traps. But here we see that Isaac believes he's about to die. And before he does, he asks Esau to do something for him. Chapter 27 and verse 1. And it came to pass that when Isaac was old and his eyes were dim, that he could not, and so that he could not see, he called Esau, his eldest son, and said unto him, "My son," and he said unto him, "Behold, here am I." So Jacob still loved his son, despite what he had done. Verse 2, and he said, "Behold, now I am old, I know not the day of my death. Now therefore take, I pray thee, thy weapons, thy quiver, and thy bow, and go out to the field, and take me some venison." I want my T-bone steaks, okay? "And make me savory meat, such as I love, and bring it to me, that I may eat, that my soul may bless thee before I die." So he tells him, "Bring me savory meat, and once you do, I will bless you before I die." That was the arrangement. And so we see in chapter 25 that Isaac still loved his son because he was an outdoorsman. He loved the meat, and he just loved his son. Now, despite him marrying outside the family, he still loved him. But Rebekah loved Jacob more, because of his plain nature and because, again, God's promise he would be the leader. So she sought to do God's work for him, which is something we should never get in God's way. We must trust God to do his will on his time, not ours. And so these shortcuts she's about to participate in lead to a disaster. Rebekah hears what Isaac tells Esau and decides to take advantage of the situation. In verse 5, "And Rebekah heard when Isaac spake to Esau's son, and Esau went to the field to hunt for venison, and to bring it, and to bring it." So he's out hunting. Esau's out in the field hunting. In verse 6, "And Rebekah spake unto Jacob her son, saying, Behold, I heard thy father speak unto Esau thy brother, saying, Bring me venison, and make me savory meat, that I may eat and bless thee before the Lord before my death. Now therefore, my son, obey my voice according to which I command thee." She's about to launch into a huge deception. Verse 9, "Now go to the flock and fetch me from thence two good kids of the goats, and I will make thee savory meat for thy father, such as he loveth. And thou shalt bring it to thy father, that he may eat, that he may bless thee before his death." So she's saying, while Esau's out doing what his father asked him to do, "Go get two goats from the flock, bring them in, I'll cook them, give them to him, and we'll make believe that you're Esau." That's just deception. But Jacob said, "Whoop, there's a problem here." In verse 11, Jacob said to Rebekah, his mother, "Behold, Esau, my brother, is an hairy man, and I am a smooth man. My father peradventure will feel me, and I shall seem to him as a deceiver, and I shall bring a curse upon me and not a blessing." So Jacob didn't argue. He just said, "This is not going to work because I don't have any hair." And so Rebekah, not to be dismayed, came up with another plan. Verse 13, "And his mother said to him, Upon me be thy curse, thy son, my son. Obey only my voice, and go fetch me them." And he went and fetched and brought them to his mother. And his mother made savory meat, such as his father loved. Not from the forest, not from hunting, but from his own flocks he brought the meat in. Verse 15, "And Rebekah took goodly raiment of her eldest son Esau, which were with her in the house, and put them upon Jacob, her younger son. And he put the skins of the kids of the goats upon his hands and upon the smooth of his neck. He dressed them in the skin of the goats and in his brother's outfit to make him feel hairy. Now, what kind of deception? That's terrible deception to do that. But she did it. She felt like this was what she needed to do. And in verse 17, and she gave the savory meat and the bread which she had prepared into the hand of her son Jacob. And he came to his father and said, my father. And he said, here am I. Who art thou, my son? This was Jacob's chance to stop the entire deception. He knew this was wrong. At least he should have known this was wrong. But did he stop it? No. He said in verse 19, and Jacob said unto his father, I am Esau, thy firstborn. I have done according as thou hast beddest me. Arise, I pray thee, sit and eat of the venison, that thy soul may bless me. Again, terrible deception. Just a terrible act of deception. Now, Isaac is not nearly as blind as maybe they thought he was. He knows something's up. And he says in verse 20, and Isaac said unto his son, how is it that thou hast found it so quickly, my son? And he said, because the Lord thy God brought it to me. Terrible thing to say, because it was an out-and-out lie. And so Isaac still suspects something is wrong, and he wants to check to see if this is indeed his son. Verse 21, and Isaac said unto Jacob, come near, I pray thee, that I may feel thee, my son, whether thou be my very son Esau or not. And Jacob went near unto Isaac his father, and he felt him, and said, the voice is Jacob's voice, but the hands are the hands of Esau. So the deception is about to work. And we see in verse 23, and he discerned him not, because his hands were hairy, as his brother Esau's hands, so he blessed him. So here we see the blessing has been stolen, and the deception will continue. And so we'll stop there for now, because the bell's about to ring on me, and I don't want the folks that have to walk out in the middle of this. But you see, but it's never right to deceive, even if you think that the reason for it is good. Whether you're handing out door hangers, inviting people to church, or even witnessing to people, we've got to maintain our integrity and, of course, according to God's will, that we don't deceive people. And I think way too many people on this earth are deceived by religiousness and not by Christianity. A lot of folks go to, quote-unquote, church because they think it makes them feel better about themselves, but they don't address the issue of salvation. And so, obviously, we're different than that here. We believe first and fully in salvation by faith through grace. But we must make sure we don't participate in anything that will bring a disreputable reputation to ourselves or to our church or to our God, because that's not worth it. It's just not worth it. And so here, Jacob and his mother participating in a huge deception of their father and husband. And so we'll see how that reacts and how it works out next time. Let's have a word of prayer. Father, again,